Anxious in Puerto Rico, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The new hurricane season is coming, and many residents of Puerto Rico are getting nervous.
They don't really believe that the government is prepared, given what happened after Maria.
We now know thousands, not dozens, died in the storm's aftermath. We'll hear about a woman killed by an infection that went untreated in the chaos after the storm. Her son is still haunted by her death.
There isn't a single day since this happened that I don't go and review those scenarios.
And later, a tale about another island. This one is part of Alaska and was a scene of a battle between U.S. and Japanese forces during World War II.
When you fight on an island, there's nowhere to retreat to. So it is a battle to the end.
Those stories coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It is good to have you with us. Last September, Hurricane Maria ripped through the Caribbean with wind gusts of more than 175 miles per hour. Today, 7 months later, we still haven't really come to grips with the economic and human costs of that storm, especially in Puerto Rico. Official government statistics put the death toll on the island at 64, but now a new Harvard study estimates Maria killed 70 times that number, nearly 5,000 Puerto Ricans. The families of those lost are still trying to sort out just how and why their loved ones died and why their deaths were never linked to the storm. One case in point, 60-year-old Elizabeth Mary Colon Merana. She was teaching electrical engineering at a Puerto Rican university in the days before the storm. Today from San Juan, her son Ruben Ramos Colon shared her story with me.
She was a teacher at the Instituto Tecnológico de San Juan. Up until the moment of the storm, she was an active member. Both of the Association of Engineers of the Island, and also a member of that academic community.
You shared a house with your mother. That's when the storm struck. Tell us about the neighborhood you were living in.
Well, we live in Old San Juan. It's where the governor's house is. It's mostly a touristic area. It's where most of the landmarks are located.
And then the storm struck. How did the two of you ride it out?
We had just been hit by Irma,
right,
just a few days before. So we already had scars. So when it got to us, we were actually, I think that we were not prepared. I think that nobody was actually prepared for that second storm or of the magnitude that the storm came to be.
Right. Yeah. No, it was much bigger than anybody was expecting. And then a few days after the storm, your mother started having health problems. What was going on? What did she notice?
Well, at first she felt some stomach pain, and we just thought it was normal based on the scarcity of water particularly. But as the days came by, she started feeling worse. At that point, we decided to take her to the hospital. For the first 24, 48 hours, there wasn't much of attention from the doctors at the hospital. They were really caught up with the huge amounts of people just pouring in.
Did your mother even have blood drawn and any labs done in that early stage when she got to the hospital?
They did the basics. The triage nurse received her, and she was taken into the emergency room. But at the emergency room, they were a little short on staff and really caught up with the outpour of people getting into the hospital. So she just stayed in the hospital bed for the first 24 hours without much attention from the doctors. At that point, we got a little bit desperate, and we started asking to particular doctors and nurses if they were going to do anything, that she was in a lot of pain. At that point, they brought a doctor. The doctor took some blood samples, and after some other 24 hours, they said that she had some kidney trouble.
Before she got to the hospital, was the water she had access to clean? What did you see?
We do not think that she got sick directly by drinking water. I think that she came into contact with water near the areas for the garbage disposal area. In San Juan, it was overrun with trash, and the services for picking up the trash were not available. So all that area was just contaminated with water and rats and all kinds of animals. So what we believe is that she came into contact with that water at some point, just going around helping out with the neighbors. So they had started a small kitchen outside of the building. So what we believe is that at some point she came into contact with what the doctor said later would be rat urine. That seems to be the reason she got the leptospirosis. It has to be directly from touching and consuming rat urine. Rats were running around the city. The huge amounts of pileup of trash just kept bringing more and more rats to the area.
And that is the cause of death listed on your mother's death certificate, suspected case of leptospirosis.
Yes, they said it was a suspected case because they didn't have the resources at the moment to make an autopsy.
If your mother had received routine care, the correct blood tests and antibiotics, what do you think would have happened?
There isn't a single day since this happened that I don't go and review those scenarios. There were no platelets on the blood bank. Blood banks were running low on everything. I made a request for most of my friends to go to the blood bank and donate platelets for her. But by then, it had been almost 6 days in the hospital, so she was really deteriorated, and there was nothing more that could be done at that moment.
Did anyone from the government contact you when your mother passed to kind of learn what happened? In other words, was your mother part of the official death toll?
No, not at all. I tried contacting the mayor's office in San Juan because she died so close to the hurricane happening that there were no place where we could bury her. Phones were down, and we never got anybody that could assist us with this.
It's such a tragic story and duplicated so many times on the island, now we know. What is the message, Ruben, you want your fellow Americans on the mainland to hear right now?
The hurricane just showed us that we're in a very vulnerable position, being a territory but not being part of the actual states. All the logistic problems that arise from this situation came to the front. Supplies were not getting into the island. International help could not send ships over to the island. They could not come directly from Europe or Africa or South America. Most of the resources that we could have got on those first 14, 21 days, which were essential to us, didn't get here. It was such a bureaucratic mess. When it came down to those initial response hours, which are so critical when this kind of scenario goes down, Puerto Rico was not prepared at all.
Ruben Ramos Colon lost his mother, 60-year-old Elizabeth Mary Colon Marana, in the wake of Hurricane Maria. Ruben, again, our condolences, and thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for keeping the world informed of the situation. Sometimes we feel very impotent over here. We don't have a lot of resources being out of the mainland. It's a human crisis. It really is a human crisis in the United States.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Even as Ruben and many other Puerto Ricans try to count the costs of last year's hurricane, here's another sobering thought. This year's hurricane season officially starts in 2 days. And the question is Puerto Rico prepared? Associated Press reporter Danica Cotto has been covering the cleanup there since the storm hit in September. Danica, we just heard the story of a woman who died because a hospital could not treat an infection after Hurricane Maria. And it seems like thousands of people may have died because they couldn't get proper medical care. How are hospitals, first of all, preparing differently for this hurricane season?
Well, they started preparing early. Obviously, there's still a lot of angst about, you know, the number of people who have died. So hospitals across Puerto Rico have bought additional generators to have at least one or two of them as backups. They're also stockpiling pieces of equipment so they don't have to wait weeks for replacements. They also plan to store enough fuel for, you know, around 15 days. And others are also expanding radio communication system in case the telecommunications network crumbles again. And at least one hospital is contracting a crew and equipment to clear roads in case their ambulances need to drive through them.
And hospitals, I presume, in San Juan are probably better equipped than hospitals outside San Juan and parts of the island.
Definitely. They have a lot more resources. So the communities, as well as the government, is helping, you know, clinics and smaller hospitals across the island, providing more resources, including some telecommunications equipment and generators.
Yeah, speaking of generators, what about the wider electric grid? Because it went through some really rough times. There was that energy company from the mainland that only seemed to delay improvements, but it's mostly been rebuilt since the storm. Is it any stronger, though, and more resilient?
If you ask Puerto Ricans, they would say absolutely not. And government officials here have conceded that the system is still quite fragile and would not survive a storm of lesser category than Maria, which was a Category 4. There's been about $3.8 billion worth of work done on it. but several months ago, there was an island-wide power outage, and actually some 13,000 customers remain without power. So the power grid remains largely unstable, but federal officials expect that by June, they'll have a plan in place on how to make it stronger and more efficient.
So the plan is to make it more resilient, but not until next month?
Correct. They're working on a plan, the federal government is, to make it stronger, more resilient. But right now, they're basically trying to still bring power to the rest of the population and then, you know, start working on how to make it stronger.
So what does the island actually look like right now? I mean, places without roofs, homes and businesses are still damaged?
Sure. The deeper that you go into the island, the more you can still see the scars from Hurricane Maria. So overall, Maria destroyed between 70,000 to 75,000 homes, and it damaged another 300,000 homes. So right now, there's about 60,000 people that are still relying on the large blue plastic tarp as a roof. And that's a big concern. I mean, granted that they're not going to withstand any kind of storm, let alone a Category 4 storm.
There was a Puerto Rican official at a press conference a few weeks ago who admitted that the Emergency Management Agency did not take updating the hurricane response plan seriously before Maria struck. But officials say they're much better prepared for this upcoming season. What exactly are they doing differently this time around?
Sure. Officials have told Puerto Ricans that they need to have enough supplies for at least 10 days, not 3 days, as was previously advised. In addition, they've also bought satellite antennas, as well as 100-watt radios, and they've distributed these to police stations, emergency management centers, fire stations, and hospitals. In addition, the Puerto Rico Telecommunication Board has notified the government that they have about 1,800 additional generators to provide backup at cell towers. And all this is important because, you know, there was no communication after the hurricane, or barely any. So that is what officials said led to some of the delay in services and supply distribution.
I mean, given Puerto Ricans' shaky personal finances right now, and not to mention their homes, are they able to stockpile 10 days of supplies? Can they do that?
They can, and they have been able to do so with help from the federal government. FEMA recently announced that it increased its storage space, and FEMA also will have 7 times the amount of food it had previously. So officials saying, you know, there's a lot of lessons learned. FEMA especially is stockpiling enormous amounts of food and water. It's also bringing in about 130 emergency high-capacity generators.
And that new warehouse space, I suspect that's a way around having material stuck at the port of San Juan, which was a real problem last year.
It was a big problem, and they're trying to avoid, you know, similar problem this time around in case another hurricane of that size strikes. But there's also warehouses across the island, so they'll be issuing water, food, and other supplies to municipalities to ensure, you know, that they're already available if they need them.
What have you heard about projections for this hurricane season, Danica? Worse than last year or about the same?
Well, the National Hurricane Center is saying there'll be about 10 to 16 named storms, and then they expect about 1 to 4 of them to be major hurricanes. So there is some apprehension, or a lot of apprehension, in Puerto Rico that the storm season will be worse or maybe the same as last year.
So some 9 months after the storm, do Puerto Ricans trust officials when they say they're prepared for another hurricane?
I don't think so. I think there's still a lot of people that, you know, remember the tough times that they went through immediately after the hurricane. And even now, you know, nearly 9 months after the hurricane, there's still some people whose homes have not been repaired. There's still some that are without water. There's still about 13,000 customers without power. And so they're fearful, you know, of another similar storm. And they don't really believe that the government is prepared, given what happened after Maria.
Danica Cotto, an Associated Press reporter who's been covering Puerto Rico for more than a decade. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up a little later on the show, a Russian journalist who was critical of Vladimir Putin is reported murdered in Ukraine. 24 hours later, he pops up alive on Ukrainian TV. Turns out his death was staged as part of a Ukrainian sting operation, and other journalists covering the story are confused.
If I were to pick one phrase that sort of crystallizes what the reaction has been, it's been something along the lines of, what the hell just happened?
The strange case of the non-murder of Arkady Babchenko. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on the show. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. This next story uncovers some history I knew nothing about. 75 years ago, during World War II, Japanese and U.S. troops fought a bloody battle on U.S. soil. It's called the Battle of Attu. Attu is an island at the end of the Aleutian chain in Alaska, which at the time was still a U.S. territory. Army veteran Alan Serrell remembers the battle. He's still haunted by the experience of staring down young men like himself.
To go out there and shoot guys that were just like me. Some of the guys noticed that it was bothering me. And they said, look, you're killed or be killed. It's your own life that you're protecting. And they were right.
Tomorrow, we'll bring you the story of what happened to the native Alaskans who lived on the island. But today, Zoe Sobel of KUCB in Unalaska has a story of the U.S. troops who fought there.
Through the early morning haze of the Arctic day, United States troops are on the move, streaming in by the thousands to take up strategic positions somewhere in Alaska.
The United News Company documented the Aleutian Campaign. In 1943, American troops were streaming into Alaska in preparation for one of the deadliest battles of World War II. That's because 1 year earlier, Japanese soldiers bombed Dutch Harbor, seized Attu Island, and took the 42 Alaska Native people who lived there as prisoners of war. It was the first time American soil had been invaded since the War of 1812. Soldiers like Bob Brocklehurst of the 18th Fighter Squadron were told that the Japanese were looking to invade the lower 48 by way of the Aleutian Chain.
They figured that the Japanese, if they had wanted to, could have come clear up in the Aleutians, taken Anchorage, and come down the east coast of Anchorage, past down Vancouver to Seattle, Washington.
But according to historian Jeff Dickrell, the Battle of Attu was really about reclaiming the stolen island.
There was a propaganda value in that. Some of the higher ranking people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff really wanted this cleared, the Aleutians cleared. They wanted to be able to say that the Japanese had been cleared from American soil.
Because the Japanese had the advantage of time, the Americans attacked with quadruple the force, more than 12,000 soldiers.
Beneath the barrage of a battleship's guns, United States forces move in to drive the Japanese from rocky, fog-bound Attu, strategic island in the Aleutian chain.
In this 1943 United News newsreel, soldiers clamber onto small boats overflowing with gear, motored ashore, and land on Attu.
The problem of supplying an expedition to take this vital subarctic outpost is tremendous. But the Americans are well trained for landing such as this, and they're bringing everything they'll need to hold Attu against any future attack.
The Americans brought heavy equipment, but the lack of roads made it useless. Signal Corps Sergeant Alan Serrell, now 102, recalled his experience in an interview with the National Park Service.
It was strictly a foot job. You had to walk, you had to carry your equipment.
The battle started on May 11th. It was supposed to last a few days, but because of the conditions, it stretched to 19. Many soldiers were young and inexperienced. Some had been training in the deserts of California for deployment in North Africa, so they weren't expecting the brutal Aleutian weather. It was constantly raining or snowing. But Serrell says worst of all was the wind.
You'd be walking along and all of a sudden you're flat on your face. It was unbearable. If you wanted to point a rifle, you just couldn't do it.
Poorly constructed leather boots that never dried and were difficult to untie led to trench foot, where tissue would die and feet would blacken and decay. On top of all that, Dickrell says the Americans had never gone head-to-head with the Japanese on land. Every other battle had happened in the sky or at sea.
When you fight on an island, there's nowhere to retreat to. So it is a battle to the end. There's no retreat. There's nowhere to go. And we didn't know how the Japanese would react to that.
By the end of May, both sides were feeling the toll of the battle. Food and supplies were scarce.
We didn't know if they would surrender once they were surrounded, or it was obvious they were going to lose. We didn't know if they would fight, you know, to the end, every single person. And the last thing we expected was a mass suicide.
The Japanese soldiers followed the Bushido Code, a samurai warrior ethic where surrender was dishonorable. They did not expect to defeat the Americans. They expected to die fighting. Every Japanese soldier who could walk assembled for a final bonsai charge, trying to catch the Americans off guard. 20-year-old Joseph Sasser was part of that last stand on Engineer Hill.
The Japanese just kept coming up the ravines, stacked on top of each other. And some, seeing that everything was futile, nothing they could do, they just took their hand grenades and pulled a pin on it and blew their stomach out completely.
Cyril was there, too. He heard the commotion and ran over.
They had the grenades wrapped around their forehead or around their chest. We lost quite a number of guys from the grenades.
549 Americans died fighting. The Japanese casualties were catastrophic. 2,300 men died and only 28 soldiers were captured. Both Cyril and Sasser helped bury the dead in mass graves. A Pathé news clip describes the scene.
After 3 weeks of costly fighting, Attu was taken, marking the first major American victory since Guadalcanal. Japan's high-water mark advance was stopped dead. A turning tide proved a military milestone of the century.
It wasn't just the fighting that killed and wounded people. Weather and disease took a terrible toll as well. Looking back on the battle, Cyril says it was hard to wrap his mind around his own survival.
When something good happened, I looked up and I said, "Thank you, God." What it did was it made me feel good to know that the war with the Japanese was over and that I survived it. Mm-hmm. But what about the poor guys that didn't survive it? The Japanese or American? Pure luck. What else can you say?
After the fighting died down, Cyril remained stationed on Attu. He spent time exploring the island, collecting samples of plants, and filling a book with pressed flowers. Now, 75 years later, he says he hasn't forgotten the battle. Back then, it bothered him to shoot people, and that's still true today.
And when you see people fall, it does something to you. I keep thinking, these people, they either have wives or they have parents. How different are they from us? They're wearing a different uniform.
Today, Attu is uninhabited. The Attuans who survived imprisonment in Japan came home to the U.S., but were never allowed to return home to Attu. The only hint of the island's wartime history is the abandoned equipment left there to rust. For the world, Zoe Sobel on Alaska, Alaska.
As I said earlier, you can hear part two of Zoe's story on tomorrow's show. She speaks with descendants of native Alaskans who were taken away from Attu Island as prisoners of war and have now gone back for the first time.
It was something I never, ever expected to happen in my lifetime, to make it all the way there.
Tune in tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on the show, a reality check on the Trump administration's policy of separating immigrant children from their parents at the border.
The director of Border Patrol said they have separated over 600 families just in a two-week period.
Wow.
So this is very different from anything that this country has ever seen before.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's something that took over my Twitter feed this past weekend. You probably saw it, too. It was about the Trump administration separating children from their parents at the U.S. border and then losing track of nearly 1,500 of them. As it turns out, those claims making waves under hashtags like "Where are the children?" and "Missing children?" they're not entirely true.
There was a little confusion and a little conflation of issues here.
Jennifer Podgill is director of policy at KIND, that's Kids in Need of Defense, which works with immigrant and refugee children.
So what is true is that this administration has put in place a policy that is systematically separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border when they're asking for asylum or some sort of humanitarian protection. Once these children are separated, they are rendered, the legal term is unaccompanied, and they then become the responsibility of Health and Human Services. The comment and the news all about children going missing actually came from a comment that a Health and Human Services representative had made during a Senate hearing a few weeks ago. He was specifically asked if HHS was staying in communication with children once they went to go live with an adult in the United States while they were going through their immigration court process. His answer to that question was, in a certain time period, when they did one follow-up phone call, which is about 30 days after a child is released from custody, there were almost 1,500 people who didn't pick up the phone during that one phone call.
So to say that these kids are missing, that's incorrect.
Exactly, exactly.
And the separation of parents and children at the border, is this a new policy? Did it happen under previous administrations?
So what the policy is, the Attorney General has said he will prosecute 100% of people apprehended at the southern border, even if they're an asylum seeker, so even if they're asking for protection, and even if they're a parent, even if they're traveling with a young child or a baby. So what happens is when that parent is going to be prosecuted, when they're criminally charged, they are sent over to U.S. Marshals. At that moment, the child can't go with them to adult U.S. Marshals custody. The government is required to send those children over to the detention facilities run by Health and Human Services. We have never seen a blanket prosecution policy intended to separate families, intended to deter future migrants from coming here and asking for protection.
Isn't it legal to ask for asylum, though?
It is absolutely legal to ask for asylum. In fact, the UN convention that talks about refugees and asking for asylum makes it very clear that that governments should not be prosecuting asylum seekers. It should not be prosecuting people who are entering without paperwork. So what the United States is doing is contrary to international law.
Well, let's hear what Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to say about this new zero-tolerance policy. This was earlier this month.
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law. If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
Jennifer, how's the Trump administration justifying this policy?
I think what they're trying to do is criminalize asylum seekers and blame parents. It's atrocious what they're doing, because I think what you need to really understand is these parents are making an impossible decision. They're risking their own lives to save their children and bring their children to a place of safety. Deterrence is not going to work in a refugee context like this right now. So I think it is a failed attempt. It was an attempt that the previous administration had also tried. There was a lot of work trying to, what they called, stem the tide of Central American refugees asking for protection in the United States. I think the solution is going to be what we can do to help make sure these communities and countries are safer so that kids and families can stay there. That's going to be the ultimate solution. I think this policy of deterrence is absolutely going to fail, and it's a very expensive way of really doubling down on a policy that's already proven to be failure.
Are you saying this policy will not deter families from trying to enter the U.S. seeking asylum?
Correct. I think the fear that people are fleeing at home is so much greater than any sort of threat the United States is doing right now, that you're not going to be able to stop people from coming here and asking for protections, nor should we. It's our responsibility. And we agreed, you know, many years ago with the other countries of the world when we signed the Refugee Convention, we've established our own robust asylum system here in the United States to adjudicate these kinds of cases. We have specially trained people, and we have a good, robust system to hear these cases out and make determinations about who needs protection here. And we need to let them work.
Are you expecting legal pushbacks like the kind of ones we've seen with the travel ban?
The American Civil Liberties Union has already filed a suit on family separations at the border, so that's currently pending in federal court right now. So we'll see what the results of this are. But I do think that in the matter of in the public court, I think Americans are really starting to speak up and say they do not stand for this. They do not want children to be ripped from their parents' arms in the name of America.
So just to be clear, because I know this is a zero-tolerance policy and that's new, but I've read the separation of children from parents also happened under Obama. Is that true?
So what we had seen before was sporadic and oftentimes unintentional separations. There were definitely problems, and we had started to engage with the government and brainstorm ways that they could improve this and to ensure that if a family inadvertently got separated, they would be able to communicate with each other, find each other again, and consolidate their legal cases if they wanted to. But that is very different from what we're seeing now. This is an intentional blanket policy. In just a two-week period, the director of Border Patrol said they have separated over 600 families just in a two-week period while they got this process going. So this is very different from anything that this country has ever seen before.
Jennifer Podkul, Director of Policy at Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
From that story about modern-day immigration policy in America to one now about a historic immigration policy, one that many Americans don't know much about. I'm talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Filmmaker Rick Burns has taken it on in a new documentary for American Experience on PBS. Erica Lee is featured in the film. She's the granddaughter of Chinese immigrants and a professor of immigration history at the University of Minnesota. Erica, thanks for being here. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, it's not very well known, but it's hugely significant as a law. Remind us why.
It's absolutely important. It is the first time that the United States as a federal government decided to ban an entire race of people from entering the United States. It was in place for 60 years. It was intended to be a temporary measure, but then lasted for 60 years, affecting generations of Chinese immigrants and really setting in motion a trend, a pattern, and legitimizing xenophobia based on race, national origin, class, all sorts of other factors that, of course, we're still dealing with today.
So whether it was a structured campaign or not, there did seem to be a long preamble of discrimination toward Chinese that led up to the Exclusion Act in 1882. The California Gold Rush played a big role in fomenting anti-Chinese feelings by other miners, white miners, many of them immigrants. What was that about?
It's a mixture of many things. First, it's the racial aspect. We have to remember that in the 1850s in California, California is admitted as a free state. We're fighting slavery, and the Civil War is going to begin in about 10 years. So we have these massive debates over who can be an American, what does that American citizen look like, who should be free, and what is the role of the United States in defining the American nationality? We have, of course, the debates over African Americans, but also the ongoing wars with Native Americans. And then we introduce a new foreign element, another potential racial problem. So race has a really important role to play. But then there's also the class element. One of the persistent anti-immigrant sentiments is the idea that immigrants take away jobs or will compete with native workers. So there is a class element as well.
I mean, emancipation was in 1863. If you read between the lines in this documentary, it almost feels like after slaves were freed, white America needed somebody else to oppress. Am I reading too much into that?
No, absolutely not. I think it all works together. Anytime we have targeted an immigrant group, even going back as far as the Irish, it's always connected to our debates over African Americans, whether slave or free, and also American Indians. When we think about it, those two groups have always been America's first others. They were never allowed to become citizens until after, for African Americans, until after the Civil War, and for Native Americans, not until 1924. So when immigrants have come to the United States, whether white or Asian or through conquering Mexicans, their place in the United States and how other they've been considered has always been measured against the first others, African Americans and American Indians.
Mm. Now, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad between 1863 and 1869 brought more Chinese immigrants to the U.S., and that also provoked a backlash. Was that over cheap labor? Like, were Chinese workers on the railroad paid less than their white counterparts?
They were. They were explicitly recruited by California's railroad barons, including Leland Stanford, who later went on to build Stanford University. They were thought to be exploitable. They were thought to be easily controlled. And they were brought in explicitly to be able to undercut the wages of both native white American workers, as well as their main competitors were Irish immigrants.
So the railroad gets completed, and then the Chinese aren't really needed anymore. Curiously, that's kind of the start of Chinatown, which a lot of people see as, you know, these lovely little places, but it didn't really start out that way. It was almost like a confinement in a way.
Right. You know, many immigrants over the course of American history have always been blamed for banding together and not assimilating. But in fact, we know that these ethnic neighborhoods, including Chinatowns across the country, were really formed because of two reasons. One, to protect themselves, and also because they couldn't move anywhere else. There were informal and formal laws that segregated Chinese from moving beyond certain areas in San Francisco, for example.
So it strikes me that the reality for the Chinese and Chinese American in this documentary presents such a contrast with the way many post-Chinese Exclusion Act Chinese in America today view the U.S. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's been fascinating. I get a lot of emails and calls from more recent Chinese immigrants, and they are often saying similar things. They'll write and they'll say, I've been in this country for 25 years. My path here was smooth, and now I'm just learning about this history. I can't believe that this happened for the generations of Chinese Americans who came before me. And it wasn't so long ago that it seemed that there was a divide within the Chinese American community, that the newer generations felt very removed and didn't find that this history was very applicable. But I think something has changed, and I think it must be the current political climate and our current debates about immigration, where many immigrant communities, even if they're considered the quote-unquote good ones, may feel vulnerable.
I have to say, watching this documentary, you know, the ban on travel of people from certain Muslim-majority countries kept popping up in my head.
Also,
it comes up more than once in the documentary, this idea that America was conceived as an oasis for people from around the world, shelter for the huddled masses. And with the election and rhetoric of President Trump, I wonder if you think we're redebating what America is. And if that's what's happening, how will this debate end?
You know, I think that we've always had a much darker relationship and view of immigrants than we like to think. We know that we celebrate the United States as a nation of immigrants, and for many, many immigrants, that is absolutely true. It has been a place where people can fulfill their American dreams, whatever they may be. But for many, many others, generations of others, they have either been banned outright, or they've been forced to live in the shadows, or they've been at risk of surveillance and deportation, including their American-born children. So this is a debate that we've had for, really, since the founding of our country. It's one that has come to the forefront, obviously, in these past few years with our new president, but is certainly one we will be continuing to have and try to resolve in the future.
Erica Lee is a professor of immigration history at the University of Minnesota. She's also featured in the new Rick Burns film about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Erica, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got a link to that film at PRI.org. Tomorrow in the World, a story out of Germany about rising anti-Semitism there in the schools. It's being blamed on new immigrants in Germany, mostly Muslims, but experts say it's much more widespread.
It happens in schools with Muslim kids, and it happens in schools where there isn't a single Muslim kid in a white German school.
In fact, most Germans have never met a Jew. So a small group of Jews in Germany provides a reality check.
Rent a Jew is an initiative where people can write to us and say we really need to see a Jew. It sounds horrible.
But their visits to schools are combating a growing problem of anti-Semitism in Germany. That story tomorrow on the show. We've reported some strange stories over the years, but this one's definitely going to make the wall of fame. Yesterday, there was shocking news of the murder of a Russian journalist in Ukraine. Arkady Babchenko was known for his critical reporting on Putin and the Kremlin. He was reportedly shot multiple times in the back. The act was decried internationally as a chilling attack on the freedom of the press. And then today, this happened. Ukrainian officials gave a press conference on the case, and yes, on stage was Arkady Babchenko, very much alive. The whole murder had been faked, staged by the Ukrainian authorities. David Stern is a veteran journalist based in Ukraine, although currently he's here in the U.S. Can you run us through what happened yesterday, David?
Well, this goes beyond a John le Carré novel. So the first report, obviously, was that Arkady had been shot in the back as he was coming back, I guess, to his apartment in Kiev. This created a huge outcry. The fact that, you know, he's a critic of the Kremlin and that he's a very outspoken one, that he's a veteran of the Chechen War, and there have been other murders. And then the story sort of went forward until today, when, in fact, we have this press conference. And as you say, I'm not in Ukraine right now. I would have loved very much to have been in the room because apparently, I mean, people were flabbergasted. I think the British word is gobsmacked.
Yeah.
There must have been a lot of just open, you know, jaws hanging there when he walked in. And he described that this was, in fact, a special operation by the Ukrainian intelligence services. There was a plot to kill him. And so they used his faked murder to find, I guess, one of the people who are involved in this. There are a lot of questions, I guess you could say, that people have at the moment.
And what you just described, is that the reason the Ukrainian government has now given for doing this kind of faked murder?
Yes. This was, as I say, a special operation done with Babchenko's cooperation, obviously. And in fact, it was so secret that not even his wife knew about this. And at the press conference, he apologized to her. You know, all you can say is that, you know, that poor woman, what she, 2 days of having to go through this. But his friends didn't know, nobody knew.
Isn't his credibility as a journalist now completely shot?
I can't say. We live in a new age. Obviously, a lot of people are saying that his credibility as a journalist has been severely damaged, as well as the media in general. It has to be said that, you know, there have been a lot of people that have been murdered, journalists and otherwise, in Kiev within the last couple of years. One person was blown up just a few hundred yards from my wife and my apartment. And then we also have the case of Pavel Sheremet, who was a journalist who was killed by a car bomb. So I'm not going to pass judgment yet. But obviously, there are concerns about his credibility and about credibility of journalists in general.
Tell us what you know about Arkady Babchenko. Who is he?
He's very prominent. It's hard to say, you know, who's the most prominent, but he's up in the upper echelons. He's a Russian, fought in the Chechen War, wrote a very well-regarded memoir about his time, and then became a fierce critic of Vladimir Putin. Left Russia when he received death threats and moved to, I believe, Prague initially, and then he's since moved to Ukraine and is recognized as one of the fiercest and one of the most prominent critics of President Putin.
So how harmful do you think this is for press freedom in Russia? Doesn't it just allow the Kremlin to now claim that any oppression is staged by foreign governments?
They're going to say that anyway. Whether they use this as a pretext or they use that as something else as a pretext. And the situation of press freedom in Russia at this moment is pretty horrible anyway. So it's a question of degrees.
So how do ordinary Ukrainians see this faked murder sting up?
The reaction has been, I guess, if I were to pick one phrase that sort of crystallizes what the reaction has been, it's been something along the lines of, what the hell just happened? Because this really is kind of uncharted territory. Nobody has ever experienced anything quite like this.
Yeah, I'll say. Journalist David Stern covers Ukraine. Thanks for being with us, David.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's wrap things up today with some music history in the making. This week, a new album by the Korean pop band BTS entered the official Billboard 200 U.S. chart. The band has already been recognized by Billboard magazine as the social media music kings 2 years in a row. And with this new CD, BTS hit another big benchmark, something no K-pop album had ever done. It debuted at number one. So clearly the U.S. is an important market for Korean pop music. If you're hearing about BTS for the first time, no problem, we got you covered. Here's my BBC colleague Morgan Eyre with a quick tutorial.
BTS are a seven-member boy band from South Korea. The group's name is an acronym for the Korean expression Bangtan Sonyeondan, literally meaning bulletproof boy scouts. They released their first album, Too Cool for School, in 2013 and have gone on to release several more albums, including versions in Japanese, and have achieved worldwide success. BTS have won a series of awards both in South Korea and around the world. They've won Best Song and Best Album at the Melon Music Awards, one of South Korea's biggest award shows, and in recent years they've expanded internationally. They picked up the Teen Choice Awards in 2017 for the Choice International Artist, and they won the Billboard Music Awards Top Social Artist in 2017 and 2018, where they performed their new single, Fake Love. The award was no surprise, seeing as they have 15 million followers on Twitter alone and another 10 million on Instagram. BTS have sold out arenas in the US, including the Staples Center in Los Angeles, which has a capacity of 21,000 people, and they're embarking on a new world tour starting in October in Seoul. From there, BTS will hit the US, Canada, the UK, Germany, France, and the Netherlands. The group's achievement at becoming number one on the Billboard charts makes their album the first primarily foreign language number one album in over 12 years.
And there you have it, the BBC's Morgan Eyre with a scoop on Korean pop sensation BTS. Their album Love Yourself, Tear, is currently number one on the Billboard 200 chart. And to complete this brief introduction to BTS, here's a taste from their single Euphoria. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I am euphorically yours, Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.